All right, Joshua, let's get into some headlines here. There's a lot of things we got to get through because there's been some talk about real estate all over the news. We're going to talk about Joe Biden's remarks on real estate when he was addressing some crowd in Nevada. I don't know if that was a pep rally or whatever that was. Let's start off with Joe Biden's speech.
It works. What we've been doing works to increase housing supply and keep costs down in the future. First, for homeowners. If inflation keeps coming down, and it's predicted to do that, mortgage rates are going to come down as well. But I'm not going to wait. I want to provide an annual tax credit that will give Americans $400 a month for the next 2 years as mortgage rates come down to put toward their mortgage when they buy their first home or trade up for a little more space if they come from a middle-class background.
What do you say, $400?
$400.
For what? Help with rent?
That's supposed to help with their payments, you know.
Is that a one-time fee?
Well, you know, so they did something like this post the last housing market collapse. They gave buyers like a $7,000 credit that they can use for their taxes. And, you know, back then they really needed to spur housing. Mm. I'm not sure, though, this is the right tool to use at this point in time. We don't have a situation where buyers aren't buying. We have a situation where we have more buyers than we have houses, so I'm not really sure this is the right tool.
Yeah, what's his angle here? Just to make buyers more incentivized to keep buying?
Yeah, but normally how this works, though, is it works where, you know, they're going to save $400 a month for the first year. They're going to give them some type of a $4,800 tax credit on their taxes.
So it's not going to be coming month to month. This is at the end of the year.
Well, at this point right now, where is it at? Like, what legislation is it in? Where is it at? We don't know the specifics of it.
So these are just dreams.
We don't know. I mean, it could be something that's in the works. We just have to wait and see what the actual legislation says and how it all breaks it down. But I don't think you're going to get $400 a month stimulus checks coming to your mailbox every month if you buy a house.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But I wanted to put that in a little bit of context in case everybody wants to celebrate with that $400. Because I don't even know what that means. Is it a one-time payment or a monthly payment, tax credit? You know.
Exactly. So, again, it was said, but it is very vague on how that is going to be rolled out.
Yeah, let's continue.
They come from a family that has well under $200,000 or less.
Oh, it's for people under 200 grand or less.
Refinance your home by eliminating title insurance fees on federally funded mortgage-backed mortgages. That's going to save folks as much as $1,500.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this right here, it gets really sticky because I can understand where he's saying that the federal government, is going to not require it. But at the end of the day, the lending institutions, they're going to require it, and because it's the thing that protects them in the event that something happens, there's an unforeseen legal circumstance that happens.
Any liens or encumbrances or claims against the title.
Exactly. So there's... You know, even for your buyers who are buying a house with cash, you're going to want a title insurance policy. But if you're buying a house with a loan, the lender requires it because they want to cover their investment in that house. And no one should go unprotected in this situation. And I get that they're saying they're not going to require it for VA, FHA, conventional
or USDA, government
USDA. Loans. They're not going to require for government-backed loans. However, you know, most of the time, if you're using a mortgage broker, they're selling their loans to somebody who's not a government entity. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they're going to probably require that charge. But if you got a retail lender who's going to service that loan, they're going to require it as well because it's their money. Your correspondence lenders who may just turn around and sell it to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, they may say, okay, well, we can get rid of this because the government is going to buy it from us anyways, so we'll be fine.
Yeah, so people out there that don't quite understand what title insurance is, it's part of your closing costs. Your lender most of the time will require it. That protects their interest in the loan. Mm-hmm. because, you know, they want that title protected in the event somebody tries to lay claim against that title. And then you got owner's title insurance. So let's say that you pay off your mortgage and the lender obviously don't require the title insurance anymore. They got their debt paid back. And let's say, I don't know, sometime down the road, 20, 30 years later, somebody lays claim against the title and some paperwork in the chain of ownership wasn't done correctly and they have a legal claim against it. And even though you own the property, they might own part of it. So that title insurance is important. Is it something you'll necessarily need? Not necessarily, but it would really suck if you didn't and you needed it.
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know, that you would rather have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
It's kind of like life insurance or car insurance. You know, it's you might not ever need to use it, but that time you do, you're going to wish.
All insurance are like that.
Yeah.
You know, car insurance, home insurance, they're all the insurance products are. You wish you never have to use them, but if you have them and you need them, you're happy.
How are they going to eliminate that?
They're just not going to require it on the government loans because most of those loans end up back with the government. So, you know, mortgage company, we won't put any names, but just mortgage company who's writing a VA home loan, they may write that loan, you know, just to originate it, and then they sell it to one of their entities, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. So because the government is going to buy it in the end anyways and hold it, they're not going to require on those. However, again, though, for those brokers who are brokering loans to different people who are going to hold them and service them for the full 30 years or a bank who's going to hold and service them for 30 years, they're probably going to require it because they want to protect their investment.
In addition, last week, the National Association of Realtors agreed for the first time that Americans can negotiate lower commissions when they buy or sell their home.
Wait a minute. Okay. I had to stop it right there. First and foremost, you've been doing real estate for 10 years. I've been doing it since 2018. I don't know any time that I have ever listed a house or helped a buyer buy a house where commissions were not negotiable.
It's always been negotiable.
Yeah. So the fact that he's saying that for the first time commissions are negotiable, I don't buy it. I don't understand what he means by that. It's always been negotiable.
Yeah, it's always been negotiable. It's really in how the real estate agents handle the conversation when they're with the sellers. That's really where the big, I guess, if anything, discrepancy is at.
They weren't. Some agents weren't saying it was negotiable.
They weren't explaining it correctly.
Okay.
They were saying, "Well, you know, I have to charge you 6% because I have to give 3% of it to the buyer's agent."
Yeah.
So when you tell somebody I have to charge you 6%, it doesn't imply that it's negotiable.
Yeah, I can see where that.
Right, and then when you say because I have to give it to the buyer's agent, people were thinking like, well, I'm paying for the buyer's agent to negotiate against me. And things like that. And it just was improperly communicated to the sellers. And that's why there is a lot of just confusion around it. But it's always been negotiable.
Yeah. So these yahoos up in Washington don't know the difference. You know, it's not like I don't even know if they personally sold their home and they had their helpers or whatever do it for them or whatever by proxy. So I don't understand. Oh, for the first time it's negotiable. That's a lie. It's always been negotiable. Whoever is saying that it's not, don't know what they're talking about. So let's continue. Clap. Ha ha ha.
On a typical home purchase, that alone could save folks an average of $10,000 on a sale or purchase. I'm calling on realtors to follow through on lowering their commissions to protect home buyers.
Okay, lowering the commissions, how is that protecting home buyers?
It's not.
Because okay, now that we got we're gonna stick it to the home buyers to make them pay agent commissions, has that made it easier or harder for them to afford a home?
I don't think it matters because sellers are still going to keep their price where their price is.
Yeah.
You know, so there's this maybe they're thinking that, you know, if we don't have to charge this person, you know, this if the sale of the home doesn't cost as much, maybe the seller will
reduce it by like 10 grand.
Exactly.
Or something.
No, that's not going to happen. That's not how sellers think. Like if you tell them your house is $500,000 and that's what I can get you for it is $500,000. Doesn't matter what the amount of commission is. Once they hear $500,000, they're locked on $500,000.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're not going to say, oh, well, okay, well, we negotiate the commissions, and because we negotiated a lower commission, oh, well, let's give the buyer a break on the price.
Yeah, no, right. I can imagine how this is going. Hey, Mr. Seller, so check it out. Now that the buyer is going to pay their own commission, I know that the comps say your house is worth $500,000, but since they're already paying their commission now, can we lower it to $490,000?
That's the reason why the whole lawsuit in and of itself is a joke, because it's not the commissions that are keeping housing inflated. It's not.
It's the buyers that are keeping it inflated and the amount of inventory.
There it is. Those two things
when
right
there.
When
you got there. Five buyers per one house, it depends on the need of that buyer. How much do they really need that house? And if they need it, they'll open up their pocketbook, take it.
Oh yeah.
Those that have more leverage or more cash to do it, they're going to do it.
Absolutely.
Because I want that. That's mine.
Exactly.
I'll take that.
Yeah. I mean, think about how many times have you been out with a client who's like, I don't want to go over $250,000.
Yeah, right.
You take them out. $350,000 later. You show them what's available, $250,000. Well, you know, maybe we can do $275,000. They go look at $275,000.
That's not much better.
Yeah, $300,000. And then before you know it, it's up there. But when they find the one they want, they're ready to go all in, you know, and whatever that is to get that house, that's what they're going to do.
It depends on the need of the client. Do they have to buy it or do they want to buy it? You know, so it just depends. And those that need it are gonna make sure they get it. They want to get their kids in a specific school zone. They're going to want to be in a specific neighborhood. They're going to want that house to have specific bells and whistles that one house may have and the other one don't. So if it's everything they want and it checks and they've already been outcompeted on another listing, you better believe they're going to open up their pocketbook to take it if they can. So, anyway, on we go.
Folks, we're also working to end the legacy of discrimination on the basis of home valuations. It's exacerbated a racial wealth gap and held back black and brown families. And it's simply wrong. You know, if a developer came along and built 20 homes on one side of a highway and 20 homes on the other, and the one side had people of black and brown backgrounds, and the same exact home was built in a white neighborhood, guess what? The day you bought that home, that black home was worth 20% less than the white home, or the Hispanic home was worth 20% less. It's wrong.
Okay, so what is he talking about? Appraisals? Appraising it lower based on racial disparities or something like that?
Yeah, and I think that's where it's going to be difficult. I mean, and you got to think about this. When you listen to this whole speech in its entirety, you know, these are key talking points that are important for everyone, right? Yeah. So, you know, this, you know, it's a campaign rally, you know, like he's rallying the base. And so, therefore, a lot of the points that are being touched on are actually focused and directed straight at the people who...
Voter demographics.
There you go. Yeah. So his constituents, right?
Yeah, he's got to give them some red meat to eat.
And so while there is this going on, I don't want to say that it's not going on. We've talked about it. We've dedicated a whole show to it a few months ago. But... essentially, what happens, though, and where the problem is going to lie, and I don't have the statistics in front of me. However, as a person who sells a lot of homes, a person who lists a lot of homes, you know, there is typically a large demographic of appraisers that are Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that the problem is necessarily where the house is built. It is in ones because all appraisals are subjective to whoever the person is that's doing the appraisal. So you could have 10 appraisers all go appraise your house and they can all come back with different numbers.
Right.
And
it's
you're
an
like,
opinion at the end of the day.
How is this possible? Well, it's possible by a lot of ways, and it's based on the fact that the whole appraisal is an opinion of what the value is.
Yeah.
I don't see how you're going to change that because there
are. You have to change people's opinions.
Exactly. You have to change people, and that's the hard part right there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, there are going to be people who are going to be like, well, hey, like this neighborhood is not like this neighborhood.
Right. You can have one neighborhood across from each other and have different taxes and different values, different school zones. It could really differ.
Yes. I've lived in several locations throughout the United States. I visited a lot of locations throughout the world during my time in the military. And I can tell you, there's almost any city I go to, I could be driving down the street like, oh, wow, this is a nice house. Oh, there's another nice house. And then it's like, whoa, where do we go wrong? Like, what are we doing? And it is, there is a difference in the level of, you know, upkeep that people give to those houses. And it really is not a clear line. As I said, you could be on the same street and drive down and be like, oh, this is a great neighbor. This is a great house, great house, great house. Whoa, what happened?
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, but there are some neighborhoods, you know, I got a listing right now where the biggest negative feedback is the person across the street is running an unofficial junkyard in their front yard.
Yeah.
And this is in, you know, a very nice neighborhood. So it is one of those things where it's like you have those issues everywhere.
Yeah.
The problem is it seems that the valuations get exacerbated in black and brown communities.
Hmm.
So when they say, hey, this neighborhood here is predominantly black and brown, and we're trying to comp it against a neighborhood that's predominantly Caucasian, that's when sometimes the appraisers are going to say, no, it's not a comparison. This is a higher level. It has more prestige. They come up with their own reason, their own, I don't want to say prejudices, but the word fits here for why this neighborhood is better than this neighborhood, right, wrong, and different. It happens, but I don't think that you can address this with policies because this is you're addressing people and the people who are making the decisions.
Yeah, so what are they going to do? You, stop being racist.
Don't
discriminate.
We did have, you know, our loan officers on, and they told us about how they have, I think he pronounced it as HMDIS or HMDA data.
In which
they have to report the demographics of it, and you know, I'm sure there's no appraiser out here who wants to hear what I'm about to say, but maybe there needs to be a tracking policy on that as well, on how they actually appraise the house in certain areas and kind of take within a mile or 2 mile radius to see how other homes are being appraised in that as well. But now you're essentially having oversight, so you have to hire people who are appraising the appraisers.
I mean, that's a good idea to have data collection like that. I don't know if appraisers have that or do that.
I don't know, but
we'll have to ask one.
There's a lot we could ask a couple, and we had some on the show not too long ago. But there is there's a lot of data that is collected, and you know, just because I've done BPOs and that, I know that, you know, on the forms, you have to put down if it's a declining neighborhood. So, you know, it all depends on how the appraiser who's doing the appraisal.
As I understand it, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, there is actually a plan, you know, for a certain city. There's the building phase, and then it plateaus, and it goes through a period of decline, then redevelopment. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Yep. So, I mean, we also there's a lot to this. You got to compare apples to apples. Same year the house is built, is it relatively the same location? Is it in the same city? You know, is it, you know, I don't know. And then I don't know. Yeah, I don't see how that's going to take care of just a little bit of policy.
No policy is going to take care of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, unless the policy that would have to be in place, and again, no one's going to want to hear this, is if there isn't data collection already that monitors the appraisers, mm-hmm. that's the only way that you can correct this.
I mean, truth is always in the data.
Yeah. And so, but if this already exists, if somewhere there's some data cruncher who's crunching and saying, hey, this appraiser typically is lower than other appraisers that appraise these houses in this neighborhood, then that's one way of finding out, right? Yeah. But if that's already in place, then there's no policy that's going to fix it.
Anyway.
You got to get more diverse in the people who are doing the appraisals.
There you go. All right, let's continue.
Second, my plan goes to work so we can bring rents down. My administration is cracking down on big corporations who break antitrust laws by price fixing to keep the rents up. That's how they work it out. Landlords should be competing to give folks the best deal, not conspiring to charge them more.
I don't agree with that. If we're talking like a big, you know, apartment building or something, likely it's owned by an LLC or S-Corp or something like that. It's some sort of business entity. And it depends. So what if they remodeled their units and they asked for more rent because they refurbished them? Or what if in that specific area rents are going up and people are willing to pay more in rent to live in that, I don't know, apartment or something like that? That's based on the demand of the market, isn't it not?
100%. And the whole philosophy and what's being said here is it's correct, but only in the right market. So if you have 100 renters and they all are starving to get the next renter in, well, yeah, they're going to give the best rate.
Yeah, they're gonna
but
lower
the
it.
Problem is there's not enough housing.
Yeah.
So until you address the housing problem that you and I have been speaking about for many months now,
yeah.
You can't expect the investors who own the properties to lower rents just inadvertently, just out of the kindness of their heart, the goodness of their heart. They're just going to lower rents when they don't have to.
No.
Because there's a housing shortage that's been created in this country that has been going on. We didn't just get this way. Yeah. We didn't just end up with a 7 million home shortage.
Yeah.
We didn't just end it. It just didn't happen.
Right.
This has been neglect in policy for many years to get to a 7.2 million home shortage in the United States.
A lot of red tape, a lot of regulation, a lot of waiting to get things approved. And, you know, not only that, it's the economic factors such as the cost of materials and inflation and all this other stuff. So these landlords, businesses, yes, they're going to get cash flow to make a profit, but they also have expenses. And they, just because that building that has all these units in it doesn't mean it's owned cash outright either. It could be leveraged. They could have a mortgage they have to pay on that. And they're paying even higher interest rates than regular residential mortgages are. I mean, just something to keep in mind. So I don't know how he's going to do that. How is he going to lower rent? Unless he subsidizes it.
Yeah, I mean, you got to look at the other side of it, though, right? So if you're going to limit and cap rent, then you're essentially going to take this investment opportunity away from those who are already putting their investment, you know, their money into it. So if you're discouraging the investment into rentals, then you're going to exacerbate the housing problem in this country.
Yeah.
Because less people will see it beneficial to rent homes. And while they may sell some of those houses and it may create some short inventory over what the price of interest rates are right now and the cost of housing period is right now, those houses will end up being sold and they'll be sold into demographics that would not be renting, right? So you're essentially going to cause a bigger gap for those who need rental units, those who, for one reason or another, can't get qualified for a home loan. Maybe they don't have the financial or they don't have the credit worthiness needed in order to buy. You're going to create a bigger problem for them. One, to the people who are left and who stay in the fight and stay in there renting. Well, now you just created a smaller pool of houses that are available for renters. So now those investors can really charge. So I think the policy that they're referring to is one that puts a cap on rent after the third year.
Yeah, I heard of that, but all a landlord has to do is say, I'm not going to renew your lease by the third year.
Yeah, they just start a new lease every year.
Yeah.
Or they start a new lease every third year.
Yeah.
But by the time that three-year cycle comes around.
They have to move to a different apartment or something.
Yeah, by the time that three-year cycle comes around, the value of that rental has now shot up even more because the pool of rental homes available is less.
Yeah, so we need to get rid of that tenant and get somebody in there who's willing to pay that rate.
So this is not necessarily the best course of action going forward because it discourages investors from buying homes that could be used as rentals.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, let's be honest, the houses that investors are buying to use as rentals in most cases, not in all cases, because there are some big conglomerate corporations that are buying up houses in middle class neighborhoods that is just, you know, it's an alarming rate at which they're buying them. But those that are in that affordable rental range, those are houses that typically need some type of investment up front to get them to being in a livable condition.
Yeah. Anyway, he can't do anything about that.
Very little.
Very little. Yeah. Let's continue. Yay.
We're also going after what I call unfair rental and junk fees. You know, like the ones you charge when you move into an apartment. One of those surprise convenience fees that aren't convenient at all. You can add up to hundreds of dollars. And some of you have been stuck with that. Folks are tired of being played for suckers, and I'm tired of letting them be played for suckers. We're also expanding rental assistance to over 100,000 more low-income families since I took office, the biggest increase in 20 years.
Okay. So convenience fees, admin fees, junk fees that he's talking about there, there's usually a reason why those fees are. I mean, you go that when you go to a car and you buy a car, they'll may charge you like a transportation fee or something like that, some other admin fee or whatever. And the reason why they charge those fees is because it's a cost to the landlord of some sort. So he's going to have to pay for somebody to process this paperwork or these filings or whatever it is that they have to do. A lot of times it's not the landlord himself or herself. It's going to be some staff member that they have that does all these, takes the intake forms and stuff. Their salaries have to get paid. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times what they'll do is they'll charge a fee to try to offset some of their costs.
Yeah, and if you reduce the fee, then you
just increase the rent.
Yeah. Well, if you reduce the fee, then you could be eliminating a job.
Yeah.
And then you have to think to yourself, what's more important here?
Yeah. Yeah, so.
And my new plan would help hundreds of thousands more, including foster kids. As you mentioned earlier, aging out of foster care. So they have to move out, living on their own for the first time. It's also going to help thousands of veterans afford the rent because no one should be homeless in America, especially someone who served this country.
As a veteran of 20 years in the United States Navy, now retired, you being as well a veteran of 20 years, now they're worried about veteran homeless vets? I mean, they've been talking about this stuff for years and nothing has happened. Matter of fact, that $150 billion they sent to Ukraine could have solved the veterans' homeless crisis by, like, what, 50 times?
Close to it.
So they have no problem anting up the money for some war in Ukraine that's going to get lost. But for some reason, vets? Yeah. I don't see anything happen for the vets. I think they're just going to be pushed to the side like normal. I think he's just trying to say words, get applause. I don't know.
It's a campaign rally. Yeah.
And folks, we know affordable housing has been a challenge for a long time. To solve it long term, we have to increase supply. Because when supply is down, demand is up, costs rise. The bottom line to lower housing costs for good is to build, build, build. That's why To help your congressional delegation, I've cut red tape so more builders can get federal financing for the new project. A record 1.7 million new housing units are under construction nationwide right now because of it. In fact, today my administration reported that single-family housing starts are the highest level they've been in nearly 2 years in my...
Okay. He's taking credit for 1.7 million homes being constructed, but wouldn't they be under construction anyway? Because that's what builders do, is build, and that was probably permits and approvals and zoning, you know, engineering, you know, or city council approvals that lasted up to, what, 2 years prior to them even breaking ground?
Yeah. I mean, there's again, it's a rally speech, right? So yeah. it's meant to, you know, to rally the base, and the mention of 1.7 million homes currently being constructed is encouraging to a lot of folks. But, you know, anyone who's done new construction, they know that, and we've had builders on the show, and yeah, they've told us that the new construction industry itself faces a lot of challenges, a lot of hurdles, particularly with labor shortage.
Yeah.
Right. You know, this generation, you know, our generation, we were basically, was pounded into our head that if you ever want to be successful, you need to get good grades and go to college and get a degree. Yeah. Right. And there are probably somewhere in some million number of people who did that, and all they got stuck with was a lot of student loan debt.
Yeah.
But we need the critical
tradesmen.
Yeah, we need the critical
tradeswomen,
skills, skilled laborers in order to carry out construction that's necessary to close the gap on the 7.2 million home shortage in this country.
Yeah.
So while 1.7 million new construction starts is encouraging, it's still far below where we need to be at. And the question is how much further will the gap, you know, expand? At what is the closure rate that they're going to get on this?
Well, they also have to, he has to also put this into context with these 1.7 million homes. Much of these homes right now, as we had the builders on before, they're talking about, they it's not that they don't want to build affordable homes. They're just no margins in there to build affordable homes. So they really have to go after, you know, homes that where incomes would be related to upper middle class or affluent. So these homes, 1.7 million homes being built, most of them I would wager are for upper middle class or the affluent. Not, these aren't affordable homes.
Yeah.
Most of them. I'm willing to say that.
I would agree with that. And, you know, in new construction, there's oftentimes there's delays with it. So, you know, you could see 1.7 million homes getting started today.
Yeah.
But they won't become available for somewhere. If you're turning out homes like Ryan Holmes is in like 4 month times, and you know, we've already done something on Ryan Holmes. Go back and watch that clip and see what the quality is that you get with a 4 month construction home.
According to the previous customers, of course,
yeah,
not
according
us.
To their customers, not us. But you know, for the builders who are building good quality homes that are going to be around for a while, you're looking 8 to 10 months. And what does that mean? You're not going to see that inventory hit the market until sometime in 2025, maybe first quarter 2025.
And it's not going to be 1.7 million homes at once.
No, it won't be. And the thing about it is they're going to hit in the wintertime when most buyers are not actually shopping for a home.
Yeah.
So, you know, we could see a situation where a lot of that inventory that's going to fall in and go on the market in the wintertime is going to sit.
Mm-hmm.
So then in 2025, you may start to see the inventory pick up some to help, you know, ease the inventory crunch that we have. But in the short, right now in 2024, you're going to probably see an inventory shortage well into the 2025 year. But again, we don't know where these 1.7 million homes are being built. if they're being built in areas that are out in the urban areas. You know, there's a lot of new construction here that's going on out in Franklin that Ryan Holmes is building, coincidentally.
Yeah.
But yeah, who wants to go live in Franklin when they work in Norfolk and they got to drive an hour to work every day?
Franklin's a very rural place in Virginia, for those who are not familiar with it.
Yeah, and that creates its own problem because...
it's not close to anything.
Exactly. So now you have a large construction going on in an area that is not developed to handle the increased population.
Yeah.
And, you know, that comes with its own set of challenges for those cities and those urban areas. Hospital times are going to go up as far as if you're sick and you need to see your doctor, you need to go to an ER.
Traffic patterns, roads.
All that. So you're going to start to see even bigger problems, which, again, will, you know, force whoever is in office in 2025 to start pumping more money into the infrastructure and developing the urban areas. But those people who actually enjoy a more country setting, you may find that your country setting is about to get disturbed.
Yeah, for real.
New plan would create 2 million affordable homes, including tens of thousands right here in Nevada. You know, and we're doing this through what they call the Neighborhood Home Tax Credit to build or renovate affordable housing. And, you know, and we do it by expanding the bipartisan low income. It's called the low income. Sorry with all these titles, but that's what these bills are. The low income housing tax credit to build affordable rental units, which is supported by lenders, builders, families and housing advocates alike. Look, my plan will also establish an innovative program to help communities build and renovate housing or convert housing from empty office spaces into housing. Empty hotels in the housing.
Did you make sense of any of that?
Yeah, I did. Okay. I actually deep dived into this, right? Okay. So what he's referring to here is the Neighborhood Homes Investment Act of 2024.
Okay.
It was a bipartisan bill that was passed. However, their goal is to get 500,000 homes rehabbed, okay, right? So... this is kind of how the plan works. And I'll tell you up front, it's not going to work.
Okay.
So they're offering a tax credit.
I don't want a tax credit. I want my money now, damn it.
Exactly. And so essentially, if I go out and I acquire a house.
Yeah.
And I get it for $50,000. Now, first and foremost, for me to acquire a house at $50,000 means that it has some serious problems.
Serious structural, right? Problems.
So it's going to cost me a good amount of money to rehab that house.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say it's going to cost me $100,000 to rehab that house, right?
Yeah.
Now, how it works is I can get a tax credit of 35% of the acquisition and the cost of rehab, but I have to sell it.
Yeah. Where to get it.
Whatever price I get it at, right?
Yeah.
So I have to sell it at $150,000. So I bought it for $50,000, rehabbed it at $100,000, and now this really nice house that I just rehabbed and put $100,000 of money into this house, I have to sell it for $150,000 in order to get a 35% tax credit.
But you wouldn't make any money if you did a 50 and 100.
Right? I get a tax credit. That's what I get.
So you got to keep the house price low? Is that?
Yeah. You get 35% tax credit of what you sell it for.
Screw that.
Right? So the sales price, right? So that math's not going to work because here's the reason why. That same $150,000, the acquisition, the rehabbing of the house itself, I will probably end up taking that house with elevated home prices right now. I could probably sell that for $300,000 to $350,000. So why would I take a 35% tax credit, which is like $52,500. Why would I take $52,500 when I can sell it for $300,000 or $350,000 and make $150,000 to $200,000? Now, you and I know,
just write off your $100,000 you put in it.
No, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, or sorry, I don't know.
It doesn't work like that. So you can't get it both ways. You can't get your cake and eat it too.
Oh, okay.
But again, for those of us who are in the industry, you know, as an investor, this is a home run deal. Like, this is the stuff that investors are, like, licking their chops for, wishing they can get every day. Like, this is, like, that porterhouse steak sitting on your plate, and you're like, I'm ready to dive into this thing. That's what this deal is, a $50,000 acquisition, $100,000 rehab for a $350,000 sale on the back end, you know, with essentially about $200,000 in profit. Why would I take a $52,500 tax credit vice $200,000 in profit?
And just pay regular business tax.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it. Nobody's going to do it.
Yeah.
Nobody with any good math sense would do it. That's why this program really isn't going to touch it. But there are limitations on it as well. And the limitations are, so I did the research in our area. Our area median income is $99,800. That is determined by HUD. So $99,800 is our area median income. Now, most, like our largest city, Virginia Beach, will tell you that the average income is somewhere around 83. So that number is a little bit elevated. However, for the sake of the math, this is what it is. So now, as an investor, I can go out in any house that I buy and rehab that is less than four times the amount of the area median income, meaning just short of $400,000, because the area median income is 99.8, so almost 100. So any house under 400,000, I can do this tax credit with, right? But then you look and the median home sale is well over that.
Yeah.
It's well over $400,000.
So why wouldn't you just do it for the median home sale?
Exactly. So the math don't work. It don't work in this area. I don't know if it will work in some other area, but if you're an investor out there in some other area, you do the math on this and let us know if it works for you.
Drop in the comments. Let us know.
Let us know if you're licking your chops to get a 35% tax credit.
All right. Continue. Almost done with this.
My plan would provide $8 billion to fight homelessness and move people into homes and off the street. Now, say it again. In the United States, no one should have to live in the street. No one. Folks all together, experts, are calling these measures, quote, the most consequential housing plan in more than 50 years. But let me be clear. It's not only my plan. It's fully paid for. And while I'm paying for it, we're also reducing the federal debt at the same time.
He's paying for it, or is the American taxpayer paying for it? That's it. That's all I got on his speech. That's all I can take.
Yeah. Again, hey, I think that it is a typical rally speech. There's a lot of great talking points there. The problem usually is, especially when you're rolling out legislation on this grand of a scale, there's a lot of bureaucratic red tape. And even just for me to track down the Neighborhood Homes Investment Act of 2024, it took a lot of work just for me to track it down, find it,
just
read
get smart
it,
on
digest
it, for a second.
It.
Yeah.
It took a lot of work to find it, right? But there's nowhere on the Virginia housing page that mentions anything about this. So what does that mean? That means that even though it's being talked about, the allocation of the funds has not been allocated to the state level. And so therefore, it's not yet accessible for those builders and those investors who are interested in the tax credit vice the profits. And so therefore, all of this was said. There's some great talking points. However, bureaucratic challenges are going to hold this down for a while, and maybe again, you might see relief in 2025. But if you need a house in 2024, your rent is up and you're tired of renting and you don't want to rent another time, like, none of this relief is going to help you in 2024.
Well, assuming he gets reelected, and then assuming that when he passes these spending bills, that the Congress and the Senate are going to agree with him.
All of that's very valid, very fair statement. And we've seen that, you know, from presidential turnover to presidential turnover, you will often see where one president says, I'm going to strike this down right here, you know, where it stands. We're doing away with this because, you know, while it was touted and there was a lot of great things that were said, when it was broken down and you figured out the math, you figured out that, no, this isn't actually paid for. It's actually taking money away from something else that we really need desperately to have this money allocated towards.
Right. That's all I got, man. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you like this video, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. We're up to over 15,000 subs. Thank you to all of you who have subscribed. You guys are awesome. Appreciate the support. Go ahead and like the video if you like it. And of course, comment. We'd like to engage in conversation with anybody. So please comment below. We try our best to reply to every comment that we get. But anyhow, with that, thanks for watching. See you soon. Until the next time.